Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening, everybody. Tonight, I wanted to offer some thoughts, some reflections around this that I've been having. One of the foundational principles that we talk about in Buddhism, that is talked about in Buddhism generally, we talk about in Zen, is the principle of interconnectedness. This principle that there is nothing or nobody that is in isolation from other things and other beings. Another word for this term is interbeing. Interbeing, that's it's a term that Thich Nhat Hanh popularized, especially in the last few years. Interbeing. So it's this principle that we are constantly in relationship with something, with many things, with myriad things, and in fact, with everything in some way or another. So in relationship, we are always in relationship with another person. We always have an effect on this other person. Other people, another person will always affect us. Or if it's not a person, it's a situation, a place, environment. And I think even if, you know, this is the principle of interbeing is something that as Buddhists, we study, we pay attention to, we practice with it in mind. I think that, you know, even the people who might not necessarily be familiar with the concept, there's something about into being that is so entrenched in being. It's kind of a fascination with many people about what things are like if I wasn't there. What would things be like if I wasn't there? You know, we say, oh, if I could be a fly on the wall, if I could be present to a situation that's not affected by me, you know, what would that look like? Because that's not something that we can ever have experience of. Often my daughter asks me what would be my superpower. And it's a pretty close tie between flying, time travel, and invisibility. Yeah, invisibility. I think about that a lot, you know, if I could be invisible and witness the world without my effect on it, what would that look like? Kind of a fun game. Because in general, you know, as a race, I think at least we're quite heavy-footed. You know, we're not a light-footed race of beings, modern humans at least. I think we try to learn to walk lightly and to understand what it means to walk lightly, but it's not easy. And I kind of think that, you know, for me, to being is an ecological principle. It's the principle of the effect that we have on our environment, on what's around us. I try to imagine, you know, a forest with nobody there, and I imagine myself walking through the forest. There's nothing that I can do if I move, you know, without changing something, or, you know, breaking twigs, cracking branches, displaced leaves, frightening away animals that were already there. But the more that I can be aware of my actions, the more that I can be aware of my presence as I'm walking through that forest, somehow the sensibility changes. If you ever go on a nature walk or a walk through the forest with somebody who's very familiar with that surrounding, that at least I feel a kind of a shift, you know, if I'm with somebody who's very familiar with the presence of animals, with the nature around, the person tends to be able to sense and spot things, you know, way before I ever would. Like, oh, there's a deer over there through the woods, you know, can hear it, can sense it, become attuned to it. So there's awareness in relationship. It's a big principle of interbeing. And in relating to other people, I often refer to the precept, you know, the first precept, not harming. Sometimes we refer to it as the precept of not killing, but it can be referred to as the precept of just not harming. First, do no harm. This is a guiding precept for me. Try not to make things worse. And as some of you know, in recent years, had the privilege of training in chaplaincy work. And a lot of the skill building around this has to do with meeting strangers, meeting people for the first time, meeting people with whom there's a great amount of difference. So how can we put each other at ease? How can I be least disturbing to a person when I meet them for the first time? And there's a kind of a principle of politeness involved in that. You know, that's just seems like a nice thing to do. And then there's also this sort of level of curiosity as well. You know, what is this? What are we like when we're in our most authentic or unguarded, maybe is a better word, states? How can we approach one another like that? So in the context of this principle of doing no harm, where, you know, every moment of our lives involves some kind of encounter, whether it's with a person or environment, a moment, a thing. How can we meet these encounters? How can we meet ourselves within this web of being? How can this principle inform our practice? That's an ongoing question for me. And so meeting ourselves, meeting myself through this frame, I think it's possible to experience ourselves both as separate and as connected. You know, like we give the example of the fingers of a hand. You know, we have separate fingers on a hand, but they're all part of the same one hand. So it encompasses both separateness and oneness. And we can experience ourselves in the same way, you know, in both ways, as separate and one. Like when I stop, when I focus my intention, inwards, I become aware of this whole life that's sort of running, this movie that's just running in the background. So if I stop and I turn that attention in, there's a meeting, there's an encounter, there's this sort of self, there's this being there. And this is the activity of meditation. It's that meeting, that bringing that attention in. And so what do we find when we do that? What's there when we do that? It's a meeting. At first, there might be this kind of sense that there's a separate self. You know, like I say, there's this kind of sense sometimes that you're sort of, at least for me, you know, if I start to meditate, there's this sense that I'm sort of, I just switched on a movie or something. You know, I've kind of entered into this stream. There's some kind of experience that I'm looking in on, you know, that I'm witnessing. There's breath. There's sensation of body. There's thought. There's like a train of thought. I always like that image, a train. It always just feels like it's going carriage by carriage, train of thought, kind of a voice, a sense of reasoning and narrative, images, plans, concepts, desires. There's a physical experience. There's an experience in the body. There might be comfort, might be discomfort. There's pulse, like a heartbeat. Temperature, tension. There are feelings, emotions, which manifest both in the mind and in the body. They can feel sometimes kind of like a cloth that overlays the whole being. That can, you know, feelings, emotions can really be located in physical places, and then you feel them very viscerally. They can define the color of the mind, you know, the color of the being. So when we come to sit, we come to practice zazen, we encounter all of this. This whole world of being human, of being a human being. So the question is, my question is, how do we enter it? How do we go into that? And my first sense around that is a kind of a soft walking. I think of not so long ago, I went with my family to the Exploratorium in San Francisco, and one of the little like science learning exhibits they have there is around sound, and they have this little thing set up where like a little room, and there's this pathway that's covered in gravel, and they have all these sound sensors set up around the pathway, and there's this challenge that people walk from one end of the pathway to the other while keeping the level of the decibels like extremely low. And so it's a challenge. You have to walk so Oh, Kelly, like, oh, very, very slowly and carefully over the gravel, and see like how little noise you can make, how little disturbance you can create. A very, very gentle approach. There's the beautiful Zen teaching, or the images within the Zen teaching, when we talk about not leaving a trace. And we can invoke the image of a bird flying through the sky that doesn't leave a trace, thinking about kind of, you know, soft movement, or a fish swimming through the water that doesn't leave a trace. And these are beautiful images. And yet it's not very often in my life that I feel like a bird flying through the air or a fish swimming through water, because I'm surrounded by things that I'm constantly bumping into, you know, people, situations, environments. I feel like this kind of koan, you know, this question of relationship is primary for me. So I hold that image of a fish or a bird as kind of an ideal. And then I know that I live in this phenomenal world, and that in many ways I'm defined by these relationships. And so part of walking softly, you know, approaching softly, one of the things to consider is, you know, I in spite of myself, I plan, you know, I strategize, I want things to be a certain way. So often there's an agenda, right? So when even, you know, meeting a person, for example, you know, so often I think these kind of agendas pass under the radar. But taking a moment to reflect, maybe, you know, just before an encounter with a person, just after an encounter with a person, we can sense that, you know, there was something that I wanted to know there, or, you know, there was something I wanted to achieve. We were getting at something. Maybe there was something I wanted to convince that person of. Maybe I just wanted to keep the exchange really short and get away, you know, but maybe there was something I was trying to push in this situation. So in Zen, you know, to kind of address this very natural tendency towards agenda making that we have, and we talk about goallessness, you know, not having an agenda in practice. You know, can we practice this? Can we practice not having purpose? So sitting down, you know, approaching Zazen practice without a goal, without a sense that there's something to achieve. And this can be really hard to do. It can be so hard to get away from the idea, you know, this kind of niggling feeling that our meditation practice should be a certain way. You know, it should be peaceful. It should be calm. Thoughts should absolutely subside. There should be no anger, fear, frustration. The mind should not wander. We should not spend the whole Zazen thinking or obsessing about something. How is it possible to enter into practice, to enter into meditation without wanting these things, without having these preconceptions somewhere? Or what is it to maybe just be with these preconceptions, to even notice that they're there? We have this phrase, meeting people where they are, you know, meeting someone where they're at. And it means that, you know, we make efforts with other people. We make efforts to enter into somebody's space, to respect somebody's mood, you know, to really listen to somebody, to really hear what it is that they're saying, not what we think that they're saying, you know, not what we'd like them to be saying, not what we're projecting in that moment, but really, you know, what is the music behind somebody's words? What is it that they're trying to communicate? Where are they? This is a kind of an engagement, a full, wholehearted engagement, giving full attention, full quality of presence. It's a kind of a readiness, you know, being oriented for any outcome, having your eyes and ears wide open, meeting someone where they are. And so the invitation with our practice can be to meet ourselves in the same way, to meet ourselves where we're at, exactly where we're at in the moment. How can we do that? How can we be a fly on the wall of our own being? For me, at least, one element in that approach is softness. I imagine, you know, like I gave that image of the gravel room, but kind of just being like a ninja. That's an image that always inspires me, you know, just quiet, ready. And in my family, we say, you know, if somebody wakes up very early in the morning and needs to do things, and like, be like a ninja, do it quietly. Don't wake anybody up. I'm trying to give a Dharma talk like a ninja right now, so I don't wake up my daughter who's sleeping in the next room. And then there's some caution around that too. You know, that softness itself is a concept also. It's easy to become hypersensitive. It's easy to become anxious. It's easy to sort of try and put oneself in the mode of softness in a way that then becomes restrictive, you know, becomes narrow. The path of practice, it's wide open. It's vast. Open on all sides. So can I meet myself in this way? Can I meet myself with openness, that same space of acceptance that I practice when I meet other people? What is it not to self-castigate, not to approach zazen like some kind of performance, like some kind of repeating moment of failure, to not walk away from a moment of practice feeling like something was achieved or there was some kind of failure? Now, how could we ever live up to the ideal of perfect practice? To think about intimacy, you know, getting intimate with another person means getting close to them. The image is being, you know, sort of being physically close to somebody, being beside somebody, or intertwined with somebody. It's a special kind of knowing. Intimacy is a special kind of knowing. And usually the more intimacy that there is, the more love arises. In the Genjo Koan, we know, a lot of us, you know, we will invoke Dogen's phrase, to study the self is to forget the self. And then in my mind, I kind of go to, and then to study the self is also to love the self. It's also to love self. Because when there's intimacy, passion arises. It's a different way of relating that kind of begins to blur the boundaries of difference. Where once things were separate, you know, through intimacy, through getting close to something, through this kind of warmth of awareness, and these boundaries start to blur. I can sit with myself, for example, and observe impatience, you know, great impatience. I'm not comfortable right now. You know, I want to move. I want to move because there's something I need to do. Something's niggling at me. You know, I'm feeling impatient. You know, there's a problem I need to solve. If I don't do it, I'm going to disappoint somebody. And maybe that person won't love me so much after I've disappointed them, you know. So I'll be sitting and all this will be whirring inside of me. And this is suffering. This is suffering in action, a form of suffering. I don't know if any of you have ever seen online, there's a very short YouTube video by Brené Brown, you know, who's a speaker. Brené Brown talks, she's saying, oh gosh, I don't want to... I don't want to label her incorrectly right now, but she's somebody who I come across a lot on the internet with, you know, great talks about self-improvement. So there's a short video that takes an excerpt of her talking empathy, and I encourage you to look it up. It's a little animated movie that somebody made, and that basically in the principle, there's this little fox who are feeling very, very sad and sort of goes down this hole and is sitting at the bottom of this dark hole. And then there's a very kind bear who kind of climbs down the hole and just sits next to the fox and says, ah, it sucks that you're down this hole. And I know what it feels like to be down this hole. So I'm just going to sit next to you and be with you down this hole. And not try to help you, not try to fix things, not try to get you back out, but let's just sit here together. So it's just this beautiful image of them sitting together, you know, side by side in intimacy. And this can, you know, when we practice this with ourselves, it starts to be a natural kind of response to ourselves. Quiet presence, careful attention, this intimacy with ourselves that gives rise to this self-compassion, you know, like a blooming flower. And then I think that, you know, going back to this experience of there being some sort of separation, you know, with attention, with intimacy, I think what starts to happen is there's a kind of an alignment. An alignment starts to happen through practice. And there might be an experience where we're no longer meeting ourselves as a stranger. We're no longer meeting ourselves as a separate being. That other self that we sort of initially perceive, that we initially come into, all these multiple selves of the body, the heart, the mind, and the consciousness that sees them all, you know, all these beings begin to align. They're invited towards one another, kind of magnetized by this intimacy, by this sense of compassion that arises from attention, from this careful attention, this gentle and observant presence. And then the experience is no longer fragmented. There's a sense of unity, of being, kind of a oneness, a oneness of disparate experience. So I'd like to finish this evening by offering you a poem that I found just recently and I was delighted by in the context of what I've been talking about tonight. It's by a poet called Derek Walcott, and the poem's called Love After Love. The time will come when, with elation, you will greet yourself arriving at your own door, in your own mirror, and each will smile at the other's welcome and say, sit here, eat. You will love again the stranger who was yourself. Give wine, give bread, give back your heart to itself, to the stranger who has loved you all your life, whom you ignored for another, who knows you by heart. Take down the love letters from the bookshelf, the photographs, the desperate notes. Peel your own image from the mirror. Sit, feast on your life. Thank you. I'd like to invite you to share any responses or if you have any questions. We'll just take a little quiet time together.
Thank you, Vanessa. There's a part of meeting myself that's kind of a little difficult. I often find that I feel like I see other people more clearly than I see myself. There's like this like haze. I don't believe my self-perceptions. Pleasantly, often find myself, I'm often surprised by myself, sometimes more often than by other people. I'm curious, how do you find that too? What is meeting yourself like?
I think to your image of haze, there's this, I think the thing that I find I need to practice with the most or struggle with the most is a kind of perhaps the fog of judgment. And judgment, you know, not necessarily negative, but just judgment in the sense of attributing value one way or another. And the kind of the paradox of that is that, you know, looking inward. And I think that's sort of what I'm trying to say tonight is, you know, looking inward is always, it can be colored. It's always kind of colored. So if I'm, you know, down and today I'm feeling particularly frustrated, that looking inward will occur in a frustrated way. You know, if I'm feeling, you know, particularly joyous today, then that looking inward will happen in a joyful way. And either way, it's kind of colored. And so with the practice itself, or with Zazen itself, there's a movement towards a little draining of that color. I guess, you know, there's the image of the silt settling to the bottom of the pond. And it's a natural effect of practice and of meditation, that kind of building clarity, that kind of clarity. And then I think less and less the fog, you know, the mist, the haze kind of begins to dissipate. I think another challenge can be, you know, when you really start to look at yourself, so many different behaviors, you know, so many different phenomena to see from so many angles. And recently I myself, I'm very interested in personality and personality theories, and specifically just in, you know, in case anybody ever wants to nerd out with me about this, I'm, you know, disclosure, I'm really interested in like the Enneagram. That's one system that I've gotten into recently. And so, you know, there's a way that the personality and landscape can be expressed as a kind of topography, you know, and on the one hand, it's like a whole, and every person can express every aspect of personality and behavior. And then there are some regions that we tend to more. And I think for me, the study of that and really, you know, getting into that and trying to spend time with that in an intimate way has been really helpful. Because it often just feels like a changing landscape. It's very hard to grasp who we are, thank goodness. You know, it really is. You can say things about yourself like, oh, I'm an X person, you know, I'm a this person and I do this and I do that. But really, we're just all over the map. Or at least I find that I am. So I think understanding that there is a challenge in this practice, and, you know, I think it's it's an important insight. I want to say it's, you know, a certain distance along the path, but it's an important insight. Yeah. Thank you, Peter. Caroline.
Thank you for your very rich talk. I think it would be worth reading it or listening to it again. You have it's packed so full with so many ideas. The part that touched me was the bear sitting in the hole. I like that part. I also liked your whole section or meeting someone where they are.
You want to say a little bit about that, Carolina? Like what part of that resonates with you, or how you relate to that?
I don't know what you said, but it was very complete, and it was thorough. And what did you say again? It was worth reading again. By practicing being very present.
Thank you. Diane.
Hi, Vanessa. Nice to see you. Your talk was very rich and complete and beautiful, as your talks always are. But it was sort of a gift for me, because when I sit and all those chattering thoughts go through my mind, or I start planning or worrying about something, I know we're not supposed to chase them away. We just let them kind of pass through. But then I start to judge myself. So I like what you said about having compassion toward ourselves in the sitting. And I guess I think everyone else, it's nice to know that other people have all these things going on. I mean, I understand no one reaches a point where they can have their minds totally empty and free of chattering thoughts or plans or worries or whatever emotion arises. But I like the idea of having compassion toward ourselves and just being with it, with the way we would treat another person. We need to treat ourselves with compassion as well. So I appreciate that. I see other people who have practiced for years and years, and I think, well, that doesn't happen to them.
Right. There's always this idea that, you know, yes, inside other people's minds is just this beautiful resonant silence. Maybe some birds chirping. Maybe some in the distance. And I think what I was trying to put forward, you know, and something that can be caution is that, you know, even this idea of like, well, I must be compassionate, you know, I should be, like this sort of should idea, you know, let me be compassionate to myself as a concept, you know, as a plan. Idea, you know, actually contained within the practice and the teaching, it's a kind of a method that doesn't require the should part. The implication, you sit down to practice, you know, attention, just being with yourself, the attention, the presence, you know, that practice that you enter into naturally lays the ground for compassion to arise. So arising of compassion that doesn't need to be forced, it arises naturally through practice. And it's an experience that you can observe. I think if there is a moment when that attention can sustain in practice, you know, when that can sustain for a little while, and then really being with what the sense of that when it comes up, often, you know, there's a warmth, you know, there's a turning towards oneself, a kind of opening and widening of the way we can be with ourselves, or we can observe it as it happens with another person or an activity. You know, we spend a whole day like very carefully doing something. There's a difference then in the way that we relate to that activity or to that person. If you just get put with a person for whatever reason, partner up with a complete stranger, to perform an activity together, you know, or something, you know, that gets you closer to somebody. And in many ways, you know, it might be somebody that you have a bad response to, or something, but there's something that shifts. There's a sensibility shift And I think that that really is, to me, such an important part of Buddhist teaching, that, you know, all Buddhist teaching, that principle of compassion, that it's not, you know, it's not we must be compassionate, we have to try mm-hmm. to be compassionate.
Mm-hmm.
It, this practice gives rise to compassion, mm-hmm. and that compassion gives rise to awakening. That that compassion helps to fertilize the ground.
Mm. Mm. Thank you so much. That's a beautiful image of how compassion arises from our practice. Thank you.
One thought that popped into my head was something that Suzuki Roshi says. He quotes Dogen saying that our practice is the term shoshaku, jushaku, one mistake after another. And how compassion, this dialogue that you and Diane were having about compassion, and you're talking about it, it's a beautiful way of it's not something that you go to directly, but it, I'm wondering if that notion of a Zen student's life being one constant mistake, if how you, is that also something you were talking about with Diane, about that interplay between, or how compassion arises naturally out of our practice?
Yeah, I really warm to that notion, Philip, and that teaching of one mistake after another. You know, it's similar to, well, for me, it's similar to what Diane was saying. You know, for me, it just loosens things up. You know, I think that I'm also somebody who has a tendency towards perfectionism in some sense, you know, or a draw towards some idea of, you know, doing things right, not getting things wrong. And I think on the surface, you know, it's easy to, it's a great caution. It's, you know, when we talk about getting religious, you know, too religious, you know, that sense, that notion is entering into a kind of perfectionism, you know, also a kind of an idealism where, you know, we're trying to attain a certain ideal, and anything falls short of it brings us into this. I can see David waving. Is somebody, are you waving at somebody, David, or somebody leaving?
I'm saying goodbye to Giuseppe. Just sent him a chat, but he has to leave.
Oh, he has to leave.
Oops, there he goes. He's gone. Bye, Giuseppe.
Yeah, chat is one thing that I definitely can't see on my screen. So you have to let me know. So yeah, one mistake after another. I think that embracing that, taking that on, you know, for me, that's been a big part of my practice. Understanding perfection, you know, understanding what we mean by, well, everything's already perfect. And that perfection includes all the mistakes. So I think we're nearly at time. There's a couple more minutes if there's any more questions or comments or sharings. Janet.
I'm sorry to have missed your talk, but it's just wonderful to see your face and to hear your voice.
Thank you. Always great to be here. I was thinking as I'm connecting this to me this morning to you this evening. I was, you know, setting up my iPad and opening Zoom. And I had this moment of like, wow, technology. Like, I'm about to meet with, you know, my Sangha group of people from France. And I'm going to turn on a screen. And I thought, gosh, you know, I grew up in the 80s. And there were movies on, you know, you'd see it on TV. Like, oh, video calls. That's the future. And then I was like, hang on, the future's here. So I figure if I keep focusing on like teleportation, it'll be the next thing. Thank you. Okay, well, thank you, everybody.
This talk was brought to you by the Cannondoe Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to cannondoe.org. That's kannondo.org.